We have people from all over the world calling in right now to listen to an interview with John Neffinger on his brand spanking new book entitled Compelling People. How you doing, John?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm so glad we can make this. And, you know, this is a book I, as you may have noticed, got really excited about because it's such a convergence of everything that I really care about and study and teach. You know, you got the psychology in there. You've got the actual applicability of everything, and it just goes deep and it's immediately applicable. So, can I first do a little brag sheet on you?
What? Oh yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, sure. Just so everybody knows who we've got here. So, first of all, this is Dr. Ali Benazir from TaoofDating.com, author of The Tao of Dating: The Smart Woman's Guide to Being Absolutely Irresistible, and today we have with us John Neffinger, and John prepares speakers and various other powerful folks to move audiences in high-stakes situations. Now, he's pretty low-key about it, but, you know, he's worked with a whole bunch of nationally world-renowned politicians and various people in industry and expert guests on TV programs. So, and he started his own little consulting firm a little while back called K&P. I believe those are the three initials of the partners. And, you know, they've been featured in the Harvard Business School case. And he lectures at Harvard Business School and Columbia Business School. And he's been featured discussing communications and audience psychology on CBS Evening News, Harbaugh with Chris Matthews, Fox News and NPR, as well as in the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And he used to work at Harvard's Kennedy School, the Council on Foreign Relations, and also as a management consultant working with executives at over 100 different big old corporations in the U.S. and all over the world. And he used to be an attorney at a top New York firm. Is this all true, John? I'm not overdoing this, am I?
That much so far, that's all true.
Okay,
we'll see about the rest
he has honors degrees from Harvard College and Columbia Law School, so he actually has credentials too. He didn't just put up a shingle and start doing this stuff. Although sometimes it may seem that's what happened. Our boy's actually got a background there. And I think the reason really why it's important to listen to this is because right out the gate, the book Compelling People, The Hidden Qualities That Made Us Influential, basically became part of the Harvard Business School curriculum. Is that true?
That is pretty much true. Yeah. In fact, before it was out. The manuscript was passed around and taught at a couple of places, including HBS. Sure.
Well, that's fantastic. So that's great. And today I would love to find out why. So let's share with our, let's share with our audience here. What is the big idea here?
Yeah. So there is one big idea, at the beginning of the book, and that's all you want. You know, you could probably pick it up at the bookstore and be done with it and 20 minutes and walk away. The big idea is that the way that we judge each other, the way we judge character when we size somebody up, or the way, it doesn't even have to be human, the way you judge a car, your emotional reaction to any thing that you see as its own thing at some level, that emotional reaction has these two components to it. There are two criteria that you're looking for. One is what we call strength, which is, to what degree can this person shape the world around them? Can it bend the world to its will? And then the other is what we call warmth, which is this person on your team or not? And the combination of these two, high one, low the other, back and forth, it turns out to predict a lot of different kinds of things, the way that we react to each other, the way that we actually see ourselves in the world as well. We judge each other judge ourselves by these criteria too. And these emotional reactions, of course, animate our behavior and govern a lot of how stuff goes down between people. So that's the beginning. The beginning of the big idea is that there are these two criteria, strength and warmth. In layperson's terms, not like strength and warmth, the particularly fancy clinical terms anyway, but strength, if you project strength, you command respect. That's the one word. And on the other hand, warmth is liking and affection and love and all kinds of different words like that. And in fact, can I do a little shout out here to
Please.
Intellectual forebears? Shout out to a guy who's not gotten a lot of shout outs this year, despite it being his big half millennium anniversary, 500 years ago this year. Niccolo, was that the guy's name? I guess it rhymes with Piccolo. Machiavelli.
That's right.
Wrote the Prince.
Good old Nick.
And, of course, the one thing that anybody remembers from that, or more likely remembers from the Office episode with Michael Scott quoting it, or whatever sort of pop culture gets recycled through these days, is this question of, is it better to be loved or feared? And, it, of course, in the context of bloodthirsty 15th century Florence, he comes up with feared. But what he actually says is right on the money from what all of the current social science says, and essentially what we're saying in this book, too, because what he says is, I used to have the sort of old English translation memorized, but the basic gist is, the question arises whether for a leader, for the prince who he's talking to, whether it's better to be loved or feared. And what he immediately says thereafter, it is best to be both, but it's very hard to combine both things in one person.
And go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No. Go. Jump
and,
right
and
in.
That's the balance that this book helps us achieve, because, you know, anybody knows how to be super strong and crush things, and it's relatively straightforward how to be warm, but it's the combination of the two that conveys the maximum amount of applicable, usable power. So that's why I think this book is super cool.
Yeah, and that's 100% right. So Machiavelli basically laid out the problem exactly right 500 years ago. And so what this book is trying to do is, starting from that jumping off point, and of course now looking at all the sort of modern updates on the social science and the thinking, whatever, but then trying to solve that riddle for people. So to try and give any reader a roadmap to try and figure out for themselves, am I projecting more strength or more warmth, and what about me projects more of one or more of the other, and then how can I navigate to a place where I'm actually doing both at once, even though it's pretty hard because there's this tension between them. And the tension actually makes sense if you think about it, because projecting strength, right, you're being assertive, you're imposing your will on the world, and that's just not that friendly a thing to do. It's just kind of a jerky move, basically. You come off like, well, you know, pick your favorite toilet word or whatever. On the other hand, the opposite of that, being accommodating, friendly, and warm, and happy to be there, and all that good stuff, is great. But the more you turn that up, the more you come across like a pushover, and like you're happy to do whatever anybody else wants to do. It's not about you. Don't worry about me. Mm-hmm. And so. They're basically going in different directions, and this is especially acutely true because a lot of the way that we judge strength and warmth is with nonverbal behavior, because we're essentially looking for somebody's emotional inner state to judge their character. That's what we're judging them on. How do they react to the world around them? What kind of demeanor do they have? And all of that then is broadcast through our nonverbals. And so our lizard brain is wired to read all these nonverbal signals from each other and from those signals to infer what's going on emotionally on the inside. And nonverbally, projecting strength is rrrrrrrrr and standing up tall and thundering around, all very unfriendly, whereas nonverbally, warmth is not very strong. So that is the tension. That is the fundamental problem that this book is aiming to tackle.
And the reason why this book is actually a Taoist book is because one of the fundamental ideas of Taoism is balance. And you have the yin and you have the yang. And you know, what is more yin than warmth? And what is more yang than strength? I mean, that's what it is. And so the idea is how to strike that balance and noticing that dynamic tension, how this requires effort. So and also going back to yin and yang, you have the feminine and the masculine. And and it's so much harder for a woman to express strength, and so much harder for a man to express warmth. So I want to make sure that we give like concrete, usable information to our listeners today on how to incorporate these nonverbal behaviors, verbal also behaviors, and various other things, because that's what that's what's really the meat of the book and what could be really life changing. So why don't we just start with a little bit of that nonverbal stuff? So, for example, what are some correlates of warmth?
Gotcha. So here's a question for all of you out in. Do you say Radioland? How do you say that?
Sure,
say
why not? Radio.
Everybody, Radioland. It's not really radio. It's whatever technology. But anyway,
radio is so
pretty straightforward question, right? So nonverbally, the number one way nonverbally now that you project warmth would be to, that's right, smile. and smiling, it's a little bit more complicated than just saying smile, not least because there are all kinds of different combinations of facial muscles firing that produce all kinds of different things, many of which we would call a smile, and yet some of them are just very different and project very different emotional internal states than others. But the smile that's actually the genuine smile, there's a French dude named Duchenne, and he got this smile named after him, but a genuine smile that involves not just the muscles around your mouth, but also the muscles around your eyes, that's the one. That's the one that all of our occipital lobe in the back of our brain. Is that right? You have the MD, so tell me if I screw this stuff up. But there's a whole lot of, yeah?
You're doing great.
Yeah. Okay, good. So the neural circuitry in the back of the head is reading these nonverbal signals, which is why not only can we recognize a person who you haven't seen in a long time, but you know who they are and you can place them and whatnot, but the recognizing the difference between a genuine smile and a not so genuine smile. It's actually really interesting. If you put two pictures of the same face, one with a genuine smile, one with a not so genuine smile, next to each other, you will immediately recognize which one is genuine and which one is not genuine on this sort of lizard brain level. But if you actually look at the pictures and you go back and forth, it takes you a minute to sort out what's different between the two, kind of like one of those highlights for children, you know, pediatrician's waiting room games. Mm-hmm. It's hard to identify the actual what's different between the two, but you know in your gut immediately. So smiling, now, this is the thing. Unless you are, little shout out to all the sociopaths on the phone, but unless you are certifiably clinically diagnosable, it's pretty hard, relatively hard anyway, to fake warmth. If you are, even people who do it for various different professional reasons, the best way to do it, the best way to project warmth is to feel warmth on the inside. We often liken when we start coaching clients, we talk about classical acting versus method acting a lot. And so classical acting school is kind of like old school Laurence Olivier. You're on the stage and you gesture this way and you twitch your eyebrow that way and they convey things, but they're not actually how human beings move through the world. The method school, that's where you have an actor who wants to play somebody who's down and out, and so they spend 2 months before the movie shoot starts living under a bridge somewhere, so they know what it feels like and they can tap into that. And so what we say, you know, if you want to project warmth, you have to find a way to be happy to be there wherever the heck you are, even if it's totally nerve-wracking and you're about to talk to people who hate you and blah 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 blah. Gallows humor is your friend in these situations. Just laugh at yourself for putting yourself through this if that's what it takes, but find some reason to get a little ray of sunshine through your black clouds there. And if you're feeling that on the inside, that will reflect itself on your face right away.
Fantastic. Now, you know, I remember reading that actually guys get a strength discount if they smile too much, if it's too much of a genuine smile, but they can counteract that with this one crazy little move. So what's that?
Well, so the balance between the two, and actually this goes back to the gender stuff that you were talking about not so long ago. The gender stuff, basically guys are expected to be strong, and they're expected to produce strength. And so to some degree, we're talking about achieving that balance, right? And so to some degree, achieving that balance it's definitely easier for us, on the whole, than it is for women, because if you're a guy and you're presumed a little bit strong. That's the presumption that your gender comes with, and you do a little bit of warmth, then that you get a nice balance pretty quickly and pretty easily. But you're absolutely right. If you instead are grinning ear to ear, not only is that projecting warmth that suggests weakness, mm-hmm. It is not in sync with your gender role. If a woman is projecting that much warmth, it also suggests maybe weakness, and it's a problem for her if she also wants to project strength, although she has some other levers to pull and dials. Certainly, we can talk about this later. But for a guy, that it doesn't work out so well because you're just giving away too much of the game for no good reason. Now, what you can do to add, is that what your question was? How do you add back strength?
Yeah, so how do you do that, that Benicio del Toro, you know, Clint Eastwood smile?
Yes. So the way that you do it, this is, man, you're skipping, you like your people, you're going right for the good stuff. So here, let me back up just for a second, if I may. So when we talk about the basic nonverbal combination of strength and warmth, right? And again, there's this tension between the two. So you gotta integrate them right if you're going to be able to pull off both at once. The basic one is something that a lot of us get told when we're sullen children being dragged to some adult event we'd rather not be at, which is, young man or lady, stand up straight and smile. And smiling, we already talked about, is the basic way you project nonverbal warmth. And standing up straight, using your muscles of your torso to straighten out the S-curve in your spine, occupying that last inch of altitude that you're capable of, no matter what your height, that projects that you are there to be taken seriously. And yet, it does not get in the way of a genuine, happy-to-be-there smile.
So I just did that right now.
There you go. And you know what? It'll make you feel good. So go for it. All of you listening on the phone, if you can do it without disconnecting, stand up and stretch out and stretch across, especially across your upper chest. That'll feel good. We'll come back to that later.
Wow.
But
that makes a big difference.
You, of course, being as cool as you are, you want people to have the good stuff. So here's the good stuff. The super good stuff, and stand up straight and smile is the kind of 101 school of how to combine these two things. We're skipping into like advanced graduate seminar version of this. But what you see on whether it's Denzel Washington or Del Toro or, you know, I still like Ann Richards. I go back to Ann Richards, governor of Texas. Not everybody knows her, but she was so fabulous with this stuff. Anyway, the 401 version of this is you have the big smile. So that's the muscles around your mouth. They're doing the smile. But what's happening with your eyes is your lower eyelids. Your lower eyelids are flexed. That does not mean, so now, what does that mean and not mean? What it does not mean is that your brow is furrowed so that you look evil because you are smiling and angry at the same time, or that you're squinting like you're at the beach. No, not that. It's a determined, it's an intense look. If any fans of what's her name, Tyra's show, anybody? Tyra Banks? Yeah, Tyra Banks. Next Top Model. She talks about smizing, which is this wonderful term for smiling without actually having a smile on your mouth, but just using your eyes to create this intense look. And so it's very similar to that, but you actually have the smile on the bottom. Anyway, so what this does is with this, by flexing your lower eyelids, which you actually can do, it gives you this intensity. And so when you're looking with this intensity at somebody, that is strength. And then the nice big smile on your mouth gives you the warmth. And so it is a singular facial expression that combines strength and warmth in one. Now, here's the big caveat with this. Women, in a professional setting, if you do this, you have to make sure that anybody that you look at this way sees you looking at lots and lots of other people this way too, or they will start to think they are very special and start to think you are flirting.
That's pretty funny.
That's that is, it's a powerful thing that needs to be used wisely. But yeah, that is, yeah, honestly, of all of the many hundreds of pages in the book, the one, and that's the thing, it's totally portable, it's totally practical. It takes some getting used to do it, and I think the context in there helps to understand a little bit.
Yeah, I'll tell you,
but it's a gem. Yeah.
As I was practicing your instructions, as I was doing them, I felt like I was becoming a mixture of Bill Clinton and Robert De Niro.
powerful yet lascivious.
Yeah.
Yes.
But De Niro told me not to name drop. So you know, I just.
All right. We call that the knowing smile. We've called it lots of other things too. And it's interesting because it does look different on different people. On Ronald Reagan, it looked like a twinkle in the eye. It looked grandfatherly. In Bill Clinton, it looks mischievous, right? You don't know quite what he's up to. It's that glint, it's that flint, it's steel. There are all these lay terms for it.
Yeah.
But it's strength in the eyes combined with the warmth of the mouth.
And actually, I do want to cover this because, you know, ladies and gentlemen who are listening, John has been coaching these people, has been in direct contact with them. So when he speaks of this, this is a direct experience. So give us a little taste of, you know, how you ended up in this filthy business and how you became an expert.
Yeah. How far back do you want? Should we start in college? Do you want me to
Well, we didn't know each other
in
college.
You remember my long hair and rock and roll days?
Yeah, I remember you in college, and it's funny how, you know, you and I both end up becoming people who dispense advice to, you know, bona fide adults out there. But, you know, we're not going to cover that part.
And similar in another way, too, which is that we both got, at least expensive, arduous to get degrees that we, it's not that we don't, I probably use mine less than you use yours, but I was an attorney for every bit as long as it took for me to pay off my law school loans and then get out of that. Essentially, I was actually, not that I graduated with a marketable skill or anything, but I was a psychology major as an undergrad. The child of two psychologists, if you can imagine surviving.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's true, in fact. My partners who I work with now, we're all frustrated speech writers, or at least we were frustrated when we were trying to be speech writers, because we would write this stuff and in our head it would come out so glorious, and then we'd hand it over to the people giving the actual speeches and it would, you know, it would fall flat, and we'd be like, geez, what, you know, what's going on here? And we got into coaching people doing this stuff, and it turned out that there was a market for that, and it turned out that we were helpful enough that people recommended us to friends, and then out of that, really the whole theory grew super organically from that. Once we started helping people give presentations and be more effective at delivering whatever message it was that they had to deliver, we found over time that there were two buckets of people, that we were either called in because this is the nicest person ever, but it's just a total pushover. Or on the other hand, that this was an abrasive personality who couldn't connect with people. And so the two categories were very evident. If anybody could pull off both of those at once, they didn't call us because they were doing great. And so it shook out very, very quickly that we could see that this is where the two fundamental problems. That it was kind of, you know, it's just a matter of combining the two. Does that sort of answer the question? How much do you want more dirt?
No, that's great. And the reason why that's important is because, as you're saying, you know, this person was pretty, had the nice thing down, but was kind of a pushover, right? And the other person, you know, just came off as a brute. Well, you know, these are the balances that people are trying to pull off every day. And, you know, especially, and if you're a guy, this is always a challenge because, you know, you don't want to stomp on people, and you do want to be able to project that warmth, but at what point do you not become a doormat, right? And with women, and for the next, you know, for the remaining half of this, I really hope we can get into the whole stuff about women and race. And just to give you guys a sense of the structure of the book. So the structure of the book is really simple. We talk about, you know, strength and warmth. That's where it is. And then we talk about the hand you were dealt. Who are you? You know, are you short? Are you tall? Are you, if you're like 6'9 and 250 pounds, well, guess what? Your problem is probably going to be with warmth, not strength, right? But if you're a five foot two woman, then yeah, that's a different issue. And then how do you play that hand? So I love the way that this book breaks all that down. And no matter how much we tell you, convey you in this 50-minute call, you know, we're not going to cover more than 5-10% of what's actually in the book. So I urge you to go forth and get the a copy. So where were we?
You were steering at some point in the direction of gender, race.
Oh yes, all that good right. Okay, and we were talking about who this stuff applies to. So whom does this stuff apply to?
Gosh, I can't think of anyone that doesn't apply.
Pretty much everybody on this planet, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's totally universal. It even applies. If there's anybody on this call who does, design or has to pick between, it applies to objects. It applies to, think about how cars are marketed. Think about how almost anything is marketed, branding, all this kind of, these two judgments determine how we emotionally react to a thing. So it's kind of crazy once you start trying to get your brain around this, all the different places this takes you. But most importantly, human interactions, this absolutely applies to everybody. And as you were pointing out, people are dealt vastly different hands. I'm trying to think if we've ever worked with anybody 6'9". We've definitely worked with some 6'6" before.
Wow.
But everybody starts in a different place in terms of what, just before they even move a muscle or open their mouth, physically what they're going to be projecting in terms of the combination of strength and warmth. And then there's nonverbal behavior, there's verbal behavior, and there's reputation, and reputation does count too for some folks. And it all goes into the same hopper where these two judgments are made. So where to go first?
Well, I think the race and gender stuff is solid gold. And also it's super controversial because, you know, after all, you and I are both white boys. So if you're lucky enough to be a white man in the society, well, guess what? You know, the power structure is oriented towards you, and therefore, you know, things are relatively easy. But if you're not, then things start getting a little tricky. So why don't we dip into that?
Absolutely. So let's go there. And I promise you, if we don't get there, remind me. There's one really interesting interaction between race and gender that will come to at the end. But let's start with gender. Let's start with gender because, as you point out, it's totally tied to these two criteria, right? The presumption, guys, we are strong, we lift heavy objects, we are supposed to be tough, women, warm, nurturing, all that kind of good stuff. And for guys, as long as you don't overdo it, as long as you don't seem so eager to please that you seem weak, starting with guy, adding a little bit of warmth, gets you pretty easily, relatively easily, to a place where you're projecting a little bit of both. Not the world's most charismatic person, but nice guy. And if you think about that term, he's a nice guy, not in the nice, like, pushover way, but like more like a good guy. That's something that's relatively straightforward and easy for guys to achieve. Women, much more complicated. There's a famous case now that a lot of people talk about. I think Sheryl Sandberg talks about this in her book as well. The case of Heidi, anyway, there was a business school case about a female entrepreneur in Silicon Valley who kicked butt and took names and was incredibly effective. And there was a professor who was using this business school case, and he had a very devilishly clever idea. He gave half the students in his class the case as it existed with Heidi and her name in there, a real person, and had them read the case. And then he gave the other half of the class the exact same case, except Heidi had become Howard. So different name, different gender pronouns, every other word exactly the same. And before the class, the professor asked folks for their impression of the protagonist of the case. And Howard, people loved Howard. Howard was great. Howard was a hero. He was the swashbuckling, you know, I don't know what. But people loved how he got it done and how clever he was, and they were rooting for Howard. Heidi? Not at all. In fact, the B word, as we affectionately call it, everybody thought Heidi was just a giant bitch. And it was kind of stunning. In fact, it was kind of stunning not only to the professor, it was stunning to the students.
This is the exact same story. You only change Heidi to Howard. Is that what I understand here?
That's it. You change the name and the pronouns. Yep, just the gender, nothing else. And it was seen, because look, I mean, this was a very dynamic and successful individual. And if a woman does the same thing, the exact same stuff that a guy does, she is not just succeeding, she is also upending the social order. Mm. She is defying expectations. And it's important to note that it was both men and women. There were, in fact, women in this business school class who did not see Heidi positively at all, who saw her as basically not playing the role that she was supposed to be playing. And there was a social penalty to her for that. And so, now, look, the good news is that these things are changing, is that every time there is a Heidi, is that every time, you know, there is a Hillary Clinton or a whomever pathbreaker, whether it's for gender or race or whatever, that our internal models shift, our archetypes get adjusted. And yeah, it's really hard on the first few people through the glass ceiling, but it does get easier for everybody else behind them, and the expectations do, and thankfully are moving in the right direction. But there's still some of that there, and it's important for folks to recognize that when they're charting their course.
Yeah, and I've been writing for an audience of women for some years, and the ladies who are listening, so, you know, you can go ahead and get mad and become righteously indignant and say, oh, this is awful stuff, but this is also just a weather report. It's just saying, look, this is what happens out there. So be aware of it and know how to modulate that strength in a way that, you know, you get the most benefit out of the way you project yourself, because this is going to happen. So if you are a powerful woman out there, then these are the way people perceive you. So it's just good to know.
100%. Now, when it comes to advice, the favorite thing to quote here is, actually, some dude came up with this, but anyway, the person who made it famous was Ann Richards when she talked to the Democratic National Convention decades ago now. She talked about how Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and how Fred Astaire was the one who was celebrated as the best dancer ever, but his partner, Ginger Rogers, did everything that Fred Astaire did, only backwards and in high heels.
Mm-hmm.
And that captures really what's going on with women. Because you got to do everything the guys do and more. It's like the and the twice as hard. And here's why. If you show up and you're a woman and you don't defy the stereotype, right, then you stick to being relatively warm and not asserting your strength, not being very assertive in the social setting. If you do that, you don't get very far. As soon as you do assert your strength, project a little bit more strength, be a little bit more assertive, then the B word descends upon your forehead, the scarlet B. So then what you got to do, not only do you have to assert the strength, then you have to assert even more warmth to balance the strength. So you have to be not only super competent, but you have to go out of your way on top of that to be super warm and nice and chummy with folks. So it's twice as hard. You have twice as much to do if you want to end up being admired like the guys.
I highlight many parts of this book. I think I have 25 pages of highlights from this book. I might as well just take one giant highlighter and just highlight the whole thing.
There you go.
Anger backlash. That was one of the nuggets I learned.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yes.
Angry behavior can count against women in many realms, perceived warmth, competence, status, and wages. So it's a form of stereotype violation. I, technical terms.
Yes. Now, think about this stereotype correlation. The word hysterectomy, we know the word hysterectomy.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Root of the word hyster is talking about the womb, right?
Yeah.
But what does hysterical mean? Hysterical means you've lost it, right? You're out of control. Your emotions, you're freaking out, and your emotions are governing your behavior. And that hysteria, that hysterical thing, it's literally, there was some kind of, I don't know, maybe you know more about this, Ollie. There was once this cultural notion that a woman's womb would wander around her body on the inside, this idea of the wandering, just crazy old,
that is truly bizarre and disturbing.
It's totally bizarre. Go, I mean, look it up online. You get lost in the rabbit holes of the internet.
Wasn't there a movie that came out like in the last year called Hysteria about you know the whole treatment of hysteria? That was, as I recall. Maggie Gyllenhaal.
I remember hearing about that. I have not seen it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's the idea that women are, you know, women, they get really emotional, they can't be trusted, and, you know, some of that has to do, you know, with getting a period and all the rest of that, but it's a bigger notion than that. And so that's the stereotype that women are up against. And so showing anger, basically, and there's a very, it's not a bright line exactly, but it's a really important one to think about. If your behavior could be termed being upset or being out of control, that is the line you don't want to cross, where it seems like you are perceiving the situation, you're having an emotional reaction, and that emotion is governing your behavior, as opposed to perceiving a situation, making a conscious decision about what it means and how best to react to it, and then choosing your own reaction, being in control of your own reaction, responding rather than reacting, sometimes people will say, an interesting linguistic distinction. That, once you're, if you're seen as upset, if you're, whether it's crying or anger especially, then the strength perception actually goes way down.
Mm-hmm.
And the warmth perception goes way down if you're going with anger actually as well too. You're violated the stereotype, and you're going to pay a social penalty for that. So for women, not recommended. For pretty much anybody who's not a straight white dude, anger is toxic in exactly that reason, that it undercuts people's social regard, with the one exception that I promised you earlier, which is there is some very interesting research that suggests that African-American women who project anger, actually, that scene is okay for them. That there's something about the interaction between the ethnicity piece and the gender piece that says that they can get away with that, and nobody begrudges them that. Which is kind of an interesting finding that I think folks haven't fully. I haven't heard a good enough explanation for it. I think it all sort of makes sense on some gut level, but I haven't heard a good articulate explanation for it.
So we talked a little bit about strength in the context of being a woman, strength in the context of warmth in the context of being a man, and I couldn't help but think of the Clintons, so Hillary and Bill. But before, because those are the stories that I mean, I think case studies are a great way for people to learn, because like, oh, you can see that picture, you know that person, that's something I can emulate, this is something I can avoid, whatever it is. But before we go into that, so what are the explicit correlates of strength? So we talked a little bit about the warm thing. So I'm here, boom. How do I, if I want to be warm, I smile, I do it in a certain way. So what's the strength thing?
Yep.
So we said stand tall, but let's get into the nitty gritty.
Yep. So we touched on two really briefly. One, stand tall, and posture is the number one way to project strength visually and verbally. The eyes thing, but that's a super advanced, you know, extra special power technique.
Yeah.
The other thing about how one carries oneself, though, besides just the posture, and this may seem sort of counterintuitive in a way, is poise. And when I say poise, I mean actually having a stillness to one's movement. You might think strength would be, I don't know, you'd exercise a lot of muscles and you'd jump around a lot. That actually makes you look out of control. Think about the way a ballet dancer moves, or a martial arts master moves, with deliberateness. They move from point A to point B, and there's no visual static. There's no wiggling of the joints. That projects strength. That demonstrates control of one's body and space. And so if you want to dial up the strength, it's actually a super easy way to do it, is just move a little bit more deliberately with stillness in between your movements and no kind of my usual thing, which is, you know, hanging out and draped all over the place and loosey-goosey. Knock that off, and it projects a lot more strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember I had an acting coach once speak at my seminar, and, and they said, just imagine you have like a ball right in the center of your being, of your body, and just imagine that you're moving from there. And that also did funny things to my way of moving, and I think it was effective.
That's really interesting. There are two things that actually popped up my mind right there that might be really practical things that people could take away. So one is actually this idea of a ball. And if you think about holding a basketball out in front of you, sort of at belly button level, and if you're holding it not with your hands on either side directly opposite at sort of 9 and 3 on the clock face, but underneath just slightly.
Got it.
At 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock, right? So just slightly underneath. And that ball can get big like a Pilates ball, and it can actually get small to the point where it's a marble, and one hand closes over the marble and the other hand kind of rests on the other hand. This ball of various sizes, and you can move it to one side or the other side, and you can have a BB in between your fingers. This idea of a spherical shape is actually really helpful. For me, I remember being the nervous guy at the sixth grade dance, and what the hell do I do with my hands? But this is also a challenge for public speakers if you don't have a clicker or a pen or whatever else. Using a spherical, granted an invisible, imaginary spherical shape, but a spherical shape is really helpful. It looks really natural, even if it doesn't necessarily feel natural immediately. And in terms of the strength and warmth, this gets really interesting. We know we're not supposed to point, right? To point at people, that's rude, and that is actually rude. We like open-handed gestures. But you can do stronger or warmer open-handed gestures. So if you think about, Jesus at the Sermon on the Mount, he's got his arms outstretched to either side in a welcoming embrace-like gesture, but his palms will be facing up. It's almost as if if you gesture with your palms facing up, it's almost like you have an invisible, not basketball, but more like a plate of cookies that you're offering somebody. It's a very welcoming, giving kind of a gesture.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, you want to project more strength, enough of this warmth stuff, I need to make sure people hear me, then take your hands and now face your palms towards one another. And make your hands into blades, and now what you have is a double karate chop, and you can shake either it's one hand or both hands at people, and that's going to give you strength.
Ooh,
that's
this is very interesting. Okay.
Directed cutting, they call this the cutting gesture in the sort of classical acting school of public speaking and that theme. And that cutting gesture is going to give you your definitive, well, nice punctuation at the end of your point. The nice thing about 10 and 4, where we started this whole exercise, is that is a combination. It is a balance of the strength and the warmth. 9 and 3 is strength, and 5:30 and 6:30 at the bottom is warmth, but 10 and 4 gives you a nice little bit of an angle on both.
Wait, so 10 and 4, so I have one hand high, one hand low?
No, shoot, I got my numbers.
I think it's four and okay. I'm eight, feeling 4 and 8 over here.
8 and 4. 8 and 4.
Thank 8 and 4. Yeah. 8 and 4 feels natural. Yeah. 10 and 4 feels like, but I'm, moving this,
no,
little
that's
ball.
Weird. No, 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 no. 8 and 4. And actually, you bring up a great point with 10 too, which is that anytime you get north, I don't know, my directions are all mixed up now. Anytime you go past 9 and 3, though, in the direction of 12, that is a problem. A lot of people will gesture at the whole audience in front of them in a way with their palm facing down that basically gives everybody the Heisman. And it creates a barrier. It looks like, some people will do it with both hands. It looks like they're trying to choke someone. It's not good. It's a very hostile gesture. So 9 and 3 is fine for strength. And yes, thank you. 8 and 4.
And just so people understand, I mean, I hope you're doing these as we're talking about it, because as you're doing it, you feel it, and you're like, oh, this feels great. And also, you know, more back to Taoism, because that's my favorite topic. All this feels like, it feels like a Tai Chi move. It's like a Qigong move. It's like you've got this ball of energy inside your hand, but that's real. That is what you're doing. And, you know, and that centers you and that grounds you. It also gives your hand something to do. So, I encourage you to use the 4 and 8, you know, holding the basketball gesture. And we're talking about basketball, beach ball, baseball. What's the hand separation here?
I mean, you can get, for the biggest points you're ever going to make, you can go to, you know, Pilates ball if you want.
Pilates ball. All right, there you go.
Depends on how much energy you want to project. The further apart your hands, the better. If you're giving a talk tomorrow, and you're going to stand up in front of the room, and you're going to say, hello, blah, 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 blah. Here's what you do. Walk up to the front of the room, pick your spot. I'm going to start talking from there. Stand on that spot, turn and face your audience, and bring your hands together, clasped one over the other, kind of like paper covers rock. Remember rock, paper, scissors?
Mm-hmm.
Paper covers rock is really good because you don't want either of your hands to display weakness. And paper is the dominant hand there, but since rock is a fist, it's also not very weak. So paper covers rock in front of you, and no, you don't have to bow like you're about to do a judo thing. But as soon as you open your mouth, open your hands. And start talking with your hands, even just a little bit, as soon as you say, hey, how's everybody doing? And you'll break the seal on your hands, and then your hands will naturally move around and start drawing pictures in support of the things that you're saying.
This is fantastic.
Oh, wait, there was one other thing. I almost forgot.
Oh.
George frickin' Clooney.
Yes.
You know the deal with him?
What's the deal with him?
You know the story?
No.
Great story. Possibly apocryphal, I don't care.
Okay. The Clooney
Spielberg.
Story. Mm-hmm.
Clooney story. Clooney story, let's say it's a true story. So Clooney had been doing, God, what was he first famous on? He had that mullet, right? I'm possibly dating myself. Anyway, so Clooney had done a bunch of silly TV shows. Did he date someone on Facts of Life? Never mind. Spielberg is credited with this, saying to him one day, You know, if you would just quit doing that thing with your head, you could be a matinee idol. And he went and he looked back, Clooney, and he watched tape of himself. And he realized what Spielberg was talking about. Many, many, many of us walk through life with a slight tilt to our neck, to our head.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you're cocking your head to one side or, you know, listening. And he did a bunch of that. And he, when he stopped and projected his full height by having his head straight up and down, then all of a sudden he was this imposing hunk of love that people would pay millions of dollars to see on the screen. And that's the one last strength versus warmth trade-off thing that I wanted to. We work with pastors sometimes, and they have the worst time with it because they're used to having their head cocked to one side listening to their flock and all the rest of it. So, head tilt is the last one that I would, would hit on for sure.
So I love how this has become very, very practical. And to bring it into the most practical realm possible, let's say, how would this play out? How would these principles play out in an interview? Give us a play-by-play.
Oh, great question. So one of the things, just to back up before we go into the sort of interviewee's point of view here, from the interviewer's point of view, very interesting phenomenon. When you get down to the last couple of candidates, there is an impulse to filter information about the last couple of candidates so that one person becomes the strong, cold one, and the other person becomes the possibly less competent, but warm, more fun to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end, partly what you're looking for, one of the things that you're trying to find out during the interview process is which are they looking for most? Is this the kind of place where they're going to take pride in getting everything done just right and the warm and fuzzy is not necessarily the priority? Or is warmth actually going to to be valued more. As long as you clear, as long as you check the box on competence, are you actually, they actually want somebody they're going to have a better time hanging out with. So that's one thing that you actually actively want to look for. But basically, to begin with, you want to do the stand up straight and smile kind of deal. Be looking for the balance, be mirroring as much as you possibly can. If you have somebody who is, who's, you know, body posture in a certain position, as long as it's not inappropriate, a little bit of mirroring there will get you warmth points, which are really good. And actually, you know what, there's one of the best strength and warmth balance studies of them all, and this is not in the book, so you can only hear this right here. Thank goodness you've been listening for all this time. There are a lot of folks out there. There's a wonderful professor by the name of Adam Grant, who's getting attention for a bunch of different things, including his policy of always doing favors for people, so it's a guy to hang out with. But there is a famous study in which one actor played four different roles, and different people saw him interviewing for a job, but in four different conditions. And different people saw him in these four different conditions, and the ratings, would you want to hire this guy or not, came out very clear. So here are the four different conditions. In two of them, he had a great resume. In two of them, he had an okay resume. Not great, but like probably could manage the job, not the worst bet. So stellar resume, and then average. In one of each of the two stellar resume conditions, in one of those interviews, he spilled coffee on himself. Same thing with the mediocre interview condition. In one of those interview conditions where he's the guy with the mediocre resume, he spilled coffee on himself. So here's the question for those of you at home can play along. The question is, there was a clear rank order of who it was that which of these four conditions would you hire first? Who would you prefer to hire as the interviewer? So worst to first, the least impressive candidate was the mediocre interview who, yes, spilled coffee on himself. Next up, the mediocre interviewer who didn't spill coffee on himself. Now, here's the question then. Which of the two stellar resume pieces, or roles rather, was preferable? Well, far and away, clear answer, with the stellar resume, when he spilled coffee on himself, everybody wanted to hire him.
Wow.
Yep. About why that is. Because if he's got the stellar resume, what's your concern about him? Well, you know he's going to get the job done, but the question is he going to be a jerk? Is he full of himself? Does he think he's all that, right? And the bumbling moment spilling coffee on himself, right? Oh, he's very human, very relatable, clearly doesn't, you know, not too caught up in himself, and doesn't think he's making a spectacular impression.
Mm-hmm.
So it's put that concern completely at ease. And that's the one that everybody wants to hire and work with.
Strength counterbalanced by a little bit of warmth.
So the question is, am I telling you that in your next job interview you should spill coffee on yourself? Well, if you have the world's best resume, maybe you should think about that. If you don't, you're clear of it. But definitely think whatever conditions you may be dealing with in a particular interview. How do you make sure you project both? And this is something we do with a lot of prominent folks, especially folks who are running for office or who need to generally be admired, is think about in front of every audience, and often this will be a short period of time, you're in front of a given audience, you're doing TV or something like that, you want to have one moment where you're for real and you're serious and you project what you're like and your nonverbals show what you're like if somebody crosses you. And it's not okay. And so you want to show people that you have it in you to be very serious when it's required and to assert yourself. On the other hand, it's great if you can also have a moment where, you know, whether it's, you know, dogs or kids or something funny, just some moment of warmth where anybody and everybody could relate to whatever it is that you're talking about. And everybody connects with you and sees that you're not only human, but just warm and caring and wonderful. And if you can hit both of those notes at least once within the course of being up in front of a particular audience, then, you know, chances are you're not doing so bad. Does that make sense?
That makes all kinds of sense, sir. I think to close out this didactic part before we go into a few minutes of Q&A, people really want to hear about, like, Bill's magical tractor beam. So how did Bill Clinton do it?
Right, that's right. We didn't talk about Bill and Hill. So the thing, like I said, you really cut the chase in the early going here. So first of all, Bill's a big guy. And in person, he's got the strength box checked more than you maybe can tell on TV. He's actually shrunk a little bit as he's aged. But then again, his stature has grown. So he still is a commanding presence. Oh, my God, it's Bill Clinton, just even if he didn't have the tractor beam going. Or even before he was known as Bill Clinton and the leader of the free world, he's a big dude. But what he will do is he will do very much eye contact. If you've read the beginning of the book, Primary Colors, you know that his handshake is a very connected one, oftentimes a two-handed handshake that can be a handshake and then the other hand up on your shoulder or even sometimes even around both shoulders. But it is that look, and he will hone in on you with the look, at the intense eyes looking directly at yours. So steady gaze, eye contact with the knowing smile, the intense eyes, and a little bit of smile on the bottom face, and not always a smile. If you're talking about something serious, his smile will go away. He will mirror your emotions back to you. But that is the tractor beam. He's taller than most folks, too. So he's looking down on you. He's physically inhabited a lot of your field of view. And then there's this incredibly empathetic, both warm and strong thing that he's got going on. And it's just, it really is a magical experience. It's a little bit unnerving how magical it is. But that's essentially what he's doing. He's using the strong eyes and empathizing along, whether it's more or less happy on the rest of his face. And then he's just honing in on you and locking eyes and not looking away.
And have you experienced
this
firsthand?
Do you want to talk about Hillary for a second? Or no, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
I think we're running out of time, and I really want people to ask questions because we did promise that they would do that. So
Hillary,
let's see,
page 34 in the book, buy the book, go ahead. All right, so what?
Before we go into questions, I just want to say, you know, this book is one of the most useful books I've ever encountered. I mean, this is a manual for being a more effective human being, and I can't imagine anything else being more important. So I urge you all to go and get yourself a copy, get your friends a copy, get a stack of them, just, you know, give them out to your friends, because this stuff works, and it works pretty much instantly. I mean, I'm standing there, I'm holding the basketball, beach ball, whatever it is. I feel it, right? I straighten up my spine. I do the flinty smile. This stuff works, and also it's very much in the vein of a book on Eastern wisdoms, because it's about self awareness and also, you know, how do you strike balance between strength, between warmth, and also modulate that in a way to make everybody else around you feel great about themselves. So I really cannot speak highly enough about this book. So. Thank you so much, John, for being here and giving us your time and sharing us your wisdom.
Sure.
And if you, now we have about 90% of the people called in are still on the call. So we have, I think, attentive audience here, and they may have questions. So if you have a question, the way you do it is you press on your phone 5-star. 5-star. What that does is over here, it makes me, see you on my little panel as having raised your hand. And when I do that, then I will click and you will hear a little something that will prompt you to ask your question. So go ahead and press 5-star on your dial pad, whatever it is, that whatever form that takes. on your iPhone or on your Skype or whatever it is. So 5-star for questions. And while people are mulling what their questions are. So, yeah, I love that story. I've talked about it before, and you put it in really cool form, talking about the primaries in Hillary and, you know, the shrink and warm thing. So feel free to go into that for a second before we field questions.
Yeah, I mean, the basic deal was Hillary had, you know, really an epic case of being branded with the B word. In fact, more people apparently, well, it's not just more people, it's that were the same people over and over again. During the 90s, more jokes were told about her on late-night TV than about any other human being ever.
Wow.
Before, or maybe since, although George W. Bush gave her a little bit of a run for the money.
Yes.
And in every one of those jokes, she was portrayed as sort of a shrew.
Yeah.
And just not a pleasant person. And so she began things got better, and she did a listening tour, which was really helpful to dial up her warmth when she ran for Senate in New York. But she was still seen as kind of a hard ass when she began the run in 2008 for the presidency, to the point where, if you remember this, she was running the 3 a.m. phone call ad against the guy in the primary when she was running against Barack Obama. She was basically taunting him as not being up to the task of dealing with our national security. That's how thoroughly she had put to rest the question of whether a woman could be in commander-in-chief or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really kind of the lasting legacy of her campaign, is she really did put that to rest. Maybe a particular woman there might be questions about, but is a woman capable of doing it? Absolutely. Nobody had any questions about that. But her whole campaign was premised on this idea. Literally, the motto of the campaign when the campaign started was restoring competence to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Competence is a very important component of strength. It has the ability to get things done. And then the other important component of strength is the will, the determination to get things done. And so it was all about strength. And it was only after she lost the primary to Barack Obama in Iowa, that first primary, that the scene shifted to New Hampshire for the second one. And right before the vote, she got asked famously by a woman in the diner, "What's it like? How do you do it?" And she did not cry. There were no tears. You can go back and watch the tape. But she did choke up, and she talked about, she said, you know, it's hard. And the facade of being perfectly poised, perfectly in control, she let us see behind that curtain, and she talked about both sort of the depth of her feeling for the mission and how she was doing it for Chelsea and wondering what kind of a world her daughter would live in. But on the other hand, she also talked about how crappy the food was on the road and just very pedestrian, relatable stuff. And we never heard her talk like that before. The public had no concept that she was capable of any of that. And there she was. She was just like her neighbor. And so she already had so much strength that she didn't throw it away by getting choked up. She had some spare. But we also saw her as warmth. And for the rest of that campaign, and now continuing to this day, she's one of the most admired women on the planet.
Love that story.
Yeah.
And again, yin and yang, warmth and strength. It's all about balance. We have a question 100%. Here. We have a question here from area code 267. Hello there.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Area code 267. Still there?
So it's probably muted.
Probably muted. You are correct.
Most of the time.
Oh, here we go. Let's unmute. Hello there, area code 267.
Hi, unmuted.
Hey, welcome to the call.
Hey, this is... Oh, thank you. Hello and hello. I'm from Philadelphia. I had a question about balancing warmth and strength. I think my natural personality is very warm, and I tend to smile a lot. So does that mean I need to reserve my smile?
Yeah. So
in order to project both.
Right. It's a great, great, great question. So there is this tension between the two, and it is true that if you project a lot of one, there is a presumption that you're probably less of the other, because strength is also a way, it's strategy for moving through life. You can assert yourself, and people don't want to fight with you, so they just kind of give in. So there's that strategy, and there's the warmth strategy for moving through life, which is you're super nice to everybody, so people like you, and so they do nice things for you. And so the thought is, if you're good at one, you probably don't have to be as good at the other. And so this is exactly the balance. So the thought is, okay, you're self-aware enough to have a pretty clear concept, it sounds like, that you're projecting more warmth than you are strength. So the question is, do you dial back the warmth? I would not say never. There are moments when, and there's such as every rule, but I would generally try and say, figure out how, instead of holding back your strength, or warmth rather, how can you dial up your strength a little bit more too? Now, the effect will be similar. If you're dialing up your strength, there are going to be more moments where you're going to be projecting more of that than you will with the warmth. And it is also true if you're, you know, just giddy and giggly and whatever all the time in situations where that's not okay, then yes, you probably shouldn't do that. But I am, you know, not having met you at all, not knowing the first thing, I'm reluctant to say, stop smiling, knock that off. Smiling is a very powerful thing. That's generally a really good thing, and you want to stick with that. The first question I would have is, how are you moving through the world the rest of the time? Are you standing up? Are you walking, striding confidently through the world, right? If you're doing more of that stuff, then you're probably balancing a little bit more. And if you're not, look in those realms first. Do that. And see if there are some other things that you can do to project more strength before you start hiding your warmth and keeping that from the world. Does that make sense?
I think I got posture down, and I think that I move through the world very confidently, but I do tend to smile a lot because I enjoy interacting with people, and I don't know if that's taking away from, you know, having the best of both worlds, if there's anything more that I can do.
Yep. So the enjoying interacting with people is a wonderful, magical thing. You really don't want to dial that down. I would look for other things that you can do. In your case, the one thing other than what you're telling me, the other thing that I could tell is that you have a relatively high-pitched voice. That is something that you can actually change a little bit. It's mostly falls in, you know, if you think about these two categories, the hand you're dealt and then playing that hand. It takes a little bit more work to be speaking from, you know, your diaphragm a little bit lower in your register. But that is something that if you can think about that a little bit, and frankly, a lot of people that we work with find it useful to go to a voice coach and to figure that kind of stuff out. That may be, you know, again, I've never met you, so I'm not going to say, oh, yes, that's the one thing that you must definitely do. But that is a big deal. The vocal tone, in addition to visual, does register with folks. So that might be one thing to think about. Also, think about what I was saying earlier about poise. That you can be doing a lot of smiling and enjoying if there's not a lot of extraneous visual static. If you're moving in a deliberate way with your gestures and you have the good posture that you say you have. Then actually, I think you're probably going to be balanced and reasonably well. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Good luck to you.
Thanks for your question. We have another question. So let's see. Area code 209. Where are you calling from, area code 209? Hello?
Hi there.
Hello.
Thank you guys for having me. Hi.
Thanks for coming. What's
Can
your
you
name?
Hear me?
Yeah. What's your name?
My name's Ronnie. I'm Ronnie.
Ronnie. Great to have you.
Thank you. I have a question. I'm kind of the opposite of the lady from Philadelphia. And I kind of am, I'm a little woman, 5'2", 130 pounds. But I've had to be strong my whole life. So I've tried to tone that down because I think it comes across as masculine energy everywhere I go. Uh-huh. But it's really hard to do that, and I don't feel safe doing that. So then I try to be more warm, which is very hard for me to do because it doesn't feel safe either. So how do I know when I'm doing enough of the warmth to balance out the strength?
So how would you know? You're looking for an external validation here, right?
Right.
That makes total sense. So this, you know, it's just, let me just pause for a second, Ronnie, and just reflect back on what I'm hearing, because when you're first of all, just the fact that you're 5'2", as soon as you said that, I was imagining being really not reluctant. I'm happy to shake hands with anybody, but having some slight trepidation in shaking your hand, because a lot of women of shorter stature, almost the same way that giant guys named Tex, you know, 6'5" guys with the belt buckle and whatever, will. And I'm curious to know if you would ever do this. If you're trying to turn up the warmth, you won't. But shake hands especially hard. Have you ever done that with folks before?
I usually do.
Yeah. And I don't begrudge you, because it is actually a great strategy for saying, yes, I may be small, but do not mess with me.
Right.
So, yep. I heard it in your voice somehow. But when you're relating this, you're talking about being afraid to be too warm. And that was literally, I think that was the term that you used. And so if you're moving through the world, and like you said before, you had to be strong for various reasons, because those were the circumstances that you found yourself in. If you're moving through the world on guard, it's going to be hard to project that warmth. There's an interesting theorist by the name of George Lakoff, who some people may have heard of, who also has this sort of idea of the world cleaved into these two realms. One is the nurturant realm, and the other one is the strict parent realm. And the strict one is a very Hobbesian view that the world is out to get you. And if that's kind of where you're approaching from, it's going to be hard to do the warmth thing. There's some stuff, and I will plug the book as part of why we're here, right? But there's some stuff in the book about how to think through approaching people with more warmth. But you will know, the answer to your question is you'll know, because you'll see people liking you more. You will see people who are enjoying your company, and that's going to help you enjoy theirs back and forth. And that stuff that you can see on people's faces, you can see it in their behavior, that there is a magnetism to warmth. That's what it's all about. It's all about connectedness. And so you'll see that in people's behavior, both large in terms of what they're choosing to do with their time, and small in terms of how they're looking at you and how they're carrying themselves around you. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
I also wanted to just throw one in. I don't know if Ann from Philly is still with us, but I'm confining my remarks here mostly to the nonverbal stuff, because that's what we're talking about, and it is so deeply connected to character and our internal states and how we judge each other. But there are, especially when you get into sort of larger functioning in life, we all play different roles in our different communities, and some of them lend themselves to projecting more strength, and others to more warmth, and so all of that counts, plus the whole realm of verbal behavior, about which we've said very little, and the kinds of the ways that you express yourself verbally also do count. So I just don't want to totally neglect those when we start getting more prescriptive as to how we balance these things. Those things count for a lot too.
Excellent. John, do we have time for one more?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Excellent. So we have area code 917, which to me looks a lot like New York City. So New York City, how you doing?
Hi, how you doing?
What's your name?
My name is Susan. I have a question. My question is, I'm in grad school, and I'm training to become an art therapist. I do many presentations. And this includes speaking in front of medical doctors and basically convincing others about the validity of my profession. However, I grew up being a Korean-American, and this actually is a difficult thing for me in terms of the eye contact thing. I mean, the idea of not meeting eyes was a really big thing for me. So how do I increase eye contact with a group? One-on-one, I'm doing fine. However, just being able to contend with my respect for others and also be able to increase eye contact is just something I've been kind of working on. So do you have any suggestions?
So, yeah, let me see if I got this right. So the eye contact has been a challenge for you to do enough of it, or is it to do specifically in situations across status differentials? Is more of the
status differentials. It's about even though I am speaking to a lot of people who are not, I guess, hierarchically not in the same status. I guess
sure.
Ways, both respect in terms of just not giving too much direct eye contact, and also being older people, people who are much more professionally.
That makes a ton of sense. So what? Did I hear you right that one-on-one you're doing okay?
One-on-one, I've been definitely challenging myself. This is very uncomfortable for me.
Okay.
I actually watch videos of myself to kind of maintain how much eye contact I'm, to see how much eye contact I'm maintaining. So.
And you're doing okay?
I believe so. I have supervisors who do look. Because I work as a therapist, I'm a therapist.
Yeah.
So that's really important for me to maintain.
So you're doing okay, but it's still challenging and uncomfortable for you in a one-on-one setting.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And then, but your question was specifically about the group setting. If you're, how large a group are we talking about? Because if it's hundreds, you're not actually expected to do much eye contact with anybody one-on-one. There are ways to distribute your gaze across the room that achieve a desired effect, but that actually could be relatively easy. Coming from where you're coming from, or is it an intermediate number? Is it like 10?
It's an intermediate. The range is from 10 to 30.
Got it. Okay. So there you are actually expected to make eye contact with everybody. If you're talking to a group of 10 people, everybody in that room is going to expect to have at least a little right on one-on-one direct eye contact. If you're talking to them for at least 10 minutes, you should have visited with everybody once or twice. So with that, I totally get the discomfort that's not how it's done, and that doesn't feel quite right. Plus there is this, you clearly feel the narrative that it does art therapy belong here. They're not only higher status in some vague way, but they're skeptical of me. What I would suggest is that if the rest of your body language is commanding respect, is projecting strength, then when you make that eye contact with somebody, the difference could be what I'm trying to suggest is that they will give you the respect that you need and that you will feel comfortable accepting it if you're projecting enough strength with everything else. Now, eye contact, just looking at somebody, can come with all different facial expressions. For you, if you can do the strong eyes that we were talking about before, and again, it's a slight flexing generally in the lower eyelid, if you can look at somebody with that kind of a determination, with that kind of a focus, and make your point, they may not be totally sure about exactly where you're saying, what you're saying and where you're coming from, but non-verbally, you will command the respect. You will earn the status non-verbally in the room to be able to do that. So I know this is uncomfortable for you. It's uncomfortable for you enough just to meet their gaze, much less to project even more strength back at them when there's some feeling of higher status or whatnot. But try what I would suggest, again, just a suggestion. My first suggestion would be to try thinking of it as a game. And try out this nifty little thing that this weird guy on the phone suggested, where you it's not glaring at somebody, but it's looking at them pointedly. It's not just meeting their gaze. there's some energy in their eyes, and specifically you can go look in the mirror, it's in your lower eyelid, and try looking at people like that. And you can add a little bit of a smile on the bottom of your face to soften it if it's feeling like you don't want to feel like you're menacing them or threatening them or anything like that. But have that intensity in your eyes and see how they react. And see if that doesn't, not only are you, it'll feel a little weird for you at first, for sure. So you can expect it to feel weird. But watch for their reaction and see if the reactions that you get from them don't end up feeling more comforting to you than what you're going through right now. What do you think of that?
What was the last part? Doesn't feel comforting to them or to me?
My bet is that if you project, you're coming in, you're the art therapy chick, okay, whatever. But if you come in and you know what you're talking about, I'm taking that for granted. But you not only you say, you speak your piece and know what you're talking about, but if you say it with a look on your face that says, you got this, because I mean it, and you should be taking this seriously. And that's what that thing that you're doing with your eyes will do. If you say it in that way, with that look on your face, I am confident that you will get a different reaction from folks. And if it's not too much, if you don't actually glare and come across as threatening to them, and again, you can avoid that by softening it with a little bit of a smile, I'm betting that you're going to like the reaction that you get from them.
I think I could definitely do that. I mean, I feel a lot of determinism, so, and I think this is something I could do. I wish I could let you know how it goes.
I wish you could, too. Well, if you can track down Ollie, right? Yeah, so what are we here?
I mean, it's what's becoming really obvious as I hear these consultations and also the entire talk is that a picture is worth 1,000 words, a video is probably worth 1,000,000 words, and you actually present in the flesh are probably worth 1,000,000,000 words. So how do people get a hold of you, and do you do consultations and trainings, and what's the story?
So my partners and I do, this is what we do. This is why we wrote this book, because a lot of people we were working with said, well, you guys should really write this stuff down. So finally we said, all right, fine, we'll write this stuff down. The way to find us is, if you know how my name is spelled, and I guess you've probably seen something with it on by now, you would have managed to get on this call. You can find me and my partners at KNP. That's, I don't know, what is that? Kangaroo, November, potato, KNP Communications, all one word together, .com. And so if you go to the website and reach out to us there, we're, you know, one-off questions are actually a lot of fun. And then we also do consultations with folks, and we do larger trainings and all that kind of good stuff. So yes, please reach out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes. And thank you so much for staying this long. We have one person who's been very patient. One quick question. Can we do that?
All right. My wife's waiting, but let's do it.
All right, let's do it. Here we go. So, 209. What do we got here? Central California. Last question.
Oh, we got one from 209.
It was an accident.
Oh, it's an accident? Oh, never mind. Okay,
yeah,
then maybe it's the Hawaii one I was looking for.
Oh, 808.
808 State. Here we go. Is there a question?
Aloha. Hi. This is I'm calling from Maui, Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to be doing some presentations, and I'm terrified of speaking in public. So I'm holding my ball, okay? How am I supposed to hold the ball kind of the whole time I'm speaking, and I'm got my imaginary ball in my hand?
That's great. That is very useful. I'll do you one better. Tell me a little bit about this public speaking setting. Where you in front of who? Where are you going to be? How big a room? Are you on a stage? Are you behind a podium?
Okay, microphone.
Yeah.
Actually, in the beginning, it'll be kind of a small group, maybe 50 to 100 people doing a presentation on a product.
That's not that small. 50 to 100 people. You're standing up there, sitting down.
I'll be standing.
You'll be standing. Do you have slides that you're projecting?
Yes, I'll have a PowerPoint, and I will have a podium.
Okay. Will you be using a microphone, and if so, will it follow you, or are you glued to the podium because that's the only way anyone can hear you?
Yeah, actually, I'll have a microphone that I can walk because I'd like to walk over and point and kind of interact
and
with.
Is it a handheld mic or is it attached to your lapel?
Well, we're working on that. I'd like to get it attached to my lapel.
Got it. Okay, so either way, you are going to get to cheat, which is good. Because if it slides, you can have the remote clicker in one hand. And if that's only if you have a lav mic. If you have the actual microphone, you're going to have to hold that sort of good old Phil Donahue talk show style. And so you're going to be gesturing with one hand, but because you're going to be holding something in the other hand, as long as you don't let it fall to your side, if you have the clicker and the clicker is just by your side, that's bad because you need to be projecting at least enough energy to use the muscles in your arm to hold the clicker at your waist or to hold the microphone up to your mouth, and then you can gesture with the other arm there too. So that's useful. You can do nice open-handed ball gestures with the one free hand you have. That's not going to deal with the anxiety, though. The whole being terrified about a piece, that's a little bit bigger deal.
Okay.
So really quick on that, assuming that you're not a physician or related to one who can prescribe beta blockers, which frankly don't always work the way they're supposed to anyway, but a couple of things. There is a TED Talk by our close comrade in arms up at Harvard Business School who did a wonderful experiment based on our warm-up routine. One of the things when we work with people is we get you a warm-up routine that feels familiar to you, that has a physical piece of calming you down and also a mental piece sort of getting you focused, getting you in the right state of mind. But just really briefly, Amy Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y, is one of the 10 most watched TED Talks of all time. She explains the experiment that she did where by stretching out and getting big, and in the experiment they helped still, we would actually suggest that you jump around a little bit and move around a little bit. But stretching across your upper chest gets rid of some of the butterflies, which is really helpful, the cortisol in your blood, and also boosts your testosterone, which is going to help you in those moments as well. So there's a physical piece that you can do here. Can you get to there are also about a dozen other anxiety reduction techniques, and for that I'm going to recommend you go get the book.
Because
my goodness, we don't have time to go through all of them.
Right.
Yeah, there's some physical stuff that you can do that will make you feel better, and there's some mental stuff that you can do to kind of psych yourself out a little bit. The last thing that I'll say, though, about public speaking anxiety is that it makes perfect sense. And we beat ourselves up all the time for, oh, my God, why am I nervous? It's so stupid. I'm just being self-destructive. It actually makes perfect sense, and I'll leave the explanation for you. You can go read it in the book. So when the wheels come off in these kinds of situations is not when we say, okay, I'm gonna be nervous. I'm going to deal with that. It's not going to be fun. Then you're going to be fine. The wheels come off when we say, I am going to be fine doing this because I know my stuff, unless I get nervous. Because you're going to get nervous. And if you get nervous about getting nervous, then you get nervous about getting nervous. But, you know, then you're in the death spiral. So it will not be the most fun couple of minutes of your life, the first couple of minutes of your talk, but there's some things that you can do to make it easier. And once you get into it after a couple of minutes, then you will notice there's this moment that happens where you're like, oh, I'm actually doing this. It's not that fun, but it's not killing me either. And then you're okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
And thank you for the question. And thank you, John, for your generosity and giving detailed coaching to these fabulous folks. And everybody, get yourself a copy. This is good stuff. And
thank you, man. I really appreciate you getting these nice folks together.
Good
crowd.
And of course, you know, it just warms my heart. We spoke about this book, you know, a year before it came out, and I'm so glad it's turned out so well. And
thank you.
And strength and warmth, balance, use the gestures,
strength and warmth,
and
people.
Go. And you will conquer the world, everybody. So thanks everybody for being on call. Actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to unmute so everybody can say a big old thank you to John. Let's see what we got here. Unmute. Here
conference
we go.
Conference unmuted.
All right, everybody say thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's fantastic. Bye. That's very gratifying. I appreciate it. You are all very, very welcome.
Yeah, and they've stuck around for 90 minutes here. So thanks again for all your patience from all over the world, England, New Zealand, Hawaii, every state in the union. And everybody, this has been Dr. Ali Benazir with John Neffinger, co-author of Compelling People. And we hope you enjoyed that and spread the word. Thank you so much. And good night.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Night. Thank you.